From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. On May 25th, 1963, the New York Times published a cover story entitled Robert Kennedy Consults Negroes Here About North. The piece, written by one of the Times' few black writers, chronicled a secret and explosive meeting that RFK had asked James Baldwin, the great writer and essayist, to convene. Attending the meeting were about a dozen prominent African-American intellectuals and artists, including Lena Horne and Lorraine Hansberry, all of whom gave RFK perhaps more than he bargained for. While Kennedy apparently walked out of the meeting angry and defensive, it came to be a defining moment for his evolution on the issue of race in America. Telling us a story of that meeting and everything it represented 50 years after RFK's assassination is Michael Eric Dyson in a new book. Professor Dyson is a prominent public intellectual, author of the New York Times bestseller Tears We Cannot Stop. He's a university professor of sociology at Georgetown University and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and contributing editor for the New Republic and ESPN's The Undefeated. And he now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called What Truth Sounds Like, RFK, James Baldwin, and our unfinished conversation about race in America. Welcome to the program, Professor Dyson.
Thanks for having me.
So first, what was it about this particular story that makes it so relevant today that made you want to try to get at what it was that happened? It happened more than 50 years ago.
That's right, 55 years ago. Well, I wanted to dig into this story because I think it offered us many parallels between what's going on now and what was going on then. Here was a prominent white politician, a liberal one, trying to engage black people about serious issues, especially the urban centers of the North, and how they were expressing black rage and how black people were in escalating fashion and increasingly attracted to figures like Malcolm X or the black Muslims, and not Martin Luther King Jr. or Whitney Young and the Urban League and Roy Wilkins and the NAACP. So I wanted to tease that out and look at how Black Lives Matter is appealing to so many African-American people, especially younger people, in light of the fact that there's been a spike in police crimes against unarmed black people, and that traditional civil rights organizations may not have been on the ground as eagerly or as readily to address these issues. And therefore, you know, a new group of leaders rose up in the face of opposition and oppression. So, you know, back in the 63, 55 years ago, these artists and activists got together with the Attorney General to discuss what was going on. And I wanted to see if we couldn't tease out, you know, Jesse Williams in our own day, you know, the makers of Get Out in our own day, Black Panther in our own day, and some of the people who have been critical as artists to our own advance, and see if a similar kind of reference point, a similar kind of response, a similar kind of meeting, if not physically, at least metaphorically, takes place when, you know, politicians and activists and artists meet. And finally, I wanted to talk about how some of the same issues, racial oppression, occur. White politicians who are not ready to hear the truth from black people, black artists meeting with, you know, high-ranking white officials. Think about Kanye meeting with Donald Trump and the like. So I'm trying to tease that kind of stuff out and look at the parallels and see if we can't learn something from them.
And what's interesting is this: that moment that you bring up in your book isn't a moment between North and South, between the racist South and the anti-racist North. It's between a liberal white politician who would be the most open non-black person one might expect to these issues, and with African-American intellectuals and really elites within the African-American community. So very specific kind of a cultural context there, right?
Absolutely right. This is no dyed-in-the-wool reactionary racist right-winger from, you know, the Confederacy. This is a northern seaboard white liberal who is ostensibly committed to the same issues, interests, and politics as those black people who met with him. and yet there was an enormous clash. Bobby Kennedy was interested in hearing from them, but only so much and from such a one direction. He didn't want to hear the rage, the pain, the anger, the trauma, the bitterness that they were expressing and experiencing. He didn't necessarily want to grapple with some of the consternation that those Black people felt. And he, quite frankly, thought that they should be more grateful for what he and his brother had done. But Black people who were gathered at that meeting, including besides Baldwin, Harry Belafonte, Lena Horne, Lorraine Hansberry, and others, Clarence Jones, the great lawyer for Martin Luther King Jr. and James Baldwin, together, they understood that this was a serious and sustained issue that Black people had to address, that the white politicians had to hear about Black rage, about Black outrage, about Black frustration at the slow pace of racial progress, especially when the Kennedys, especially Jack Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, the brother of Bobby Kennedy, was so deliberate and, in fact, stalling on racial progress. On the one hand, he promised Black people that he would do something about civil rights legislation, though he was slow on the uptake. On the other hand, he's putting racists on the bench, and he's promising Southern governors that he won't use federal power to intervene on segregation. So he was trying to play both ends against the middle. And so this white liberal politician ended up being the whipping boy for their anger and rage, and rightfully so, because he didn't really understand until that meeting the depth of the Black rage that was besieging these communities and the profundity of that rage, even as it was expressed among Black people who were elites. These weren't Black people who were lumping proletariat, with the exception of Jerome Smith, in many ways, the linchpin and the core of that meeting, as a member of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, and a freedom rider who was the most decorated, along with John Lewis, of all of those freedom riders for having endured so much physical assault and pain in his body. So, you know, these were Black elites who were nevertheless full of rage. They were expressing the rage of masses of Black people in America. Bobby Kennedy, as a white liberal, got pissed, got upset, got angry at that. And at the end of that meeting, he actually sicked the FBI on them. He got the dossiers of many of the people there gathered, and if they had not been started, he started them. And then eventually that led to the surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. under his signature.
Wow.
Then he calmed down
and said,
you're right, wow is right, that the white politician, the liberal white politician, the liberal white attorney general of the United States is the one who okayed the wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr., supposedly to discover if there were, communist presences that had infiltrated his organization. But really, J. Edgar Hoover had a program of domestic surveillance that intended to intimidate and to discourage Black organizations, among many others, that eventuated in COINTELPRO program later on. So, yeah, then when he calmed down, Bobby Kennedy said, you know what, if I were a Black man or a Black person, I might be full of rage as well. And I've got to understand their perspective. And then he said one of the things they wanted me to do was to speak about race as not only a political issue, but a moral one. And how do we talk about leveraging the moral authority of the country in light of its complicated and vastly difficult backdrop, and do it in a way that would be productive and helpful for Black America by saying that this stuff is wrong, not just that we don't have public policy to address it, but it's morally reprehensible, and we must use our resources to address this issue. And then he got his brother to do the same, and then it changed his own life. And for the next 5 years until he was assassinated, he became increasingly sympathetic to those particular positions and empathetic to Black people, and became eventually known as the most trusted white man in America.
It feels like this is exactly the kind of confrontation that needed to take place, because even today we see these misguided attempts to rewrite what it is that Black athletes are doing at football games by people who have no idea what Black America goes through, and because they don't experience it personally, they completely misunderstand understand it and write it off as being an insult. And of course, our president fanning the flames of that. But even back 55 years ago, that conversation that you describe in your book, you describe RFK trying to lecture to the folks amassed there about everything the government had done for them and how it was that they were still so angry. But it was a necessary education for him, right? The attorney general of the country, who should have been aware of this, but clearly was utterly ignorant.
Utterly ignorant, should have been aware. At one point, Lorraine Hansberry said, if you don't understand and you're a young white politician, and you know they're thinking to themselves, if he doesn't get it, then no one will. Mm-hmm. A young white, relatively liberal politician who is perfectly situated to understand the plight and predicament of black people. And if he doesn't get it, then nobody's going to get it. So they were discouraged from that perspective because there seemed to be a tremendous impasse between their insistence on addressing issues of race and rage and his resistance to it by thinking that they should be grateful by lecturing them about what the administration had done. And furthermore, and does this sound familiar? Trying to tell them, hey, we don't want to alienate white voters from the Democratic Party. We want to recruit them back in. So we don't want to look as if, you know, basically he's saying to them, implying to them that we're too radical on the race issue in order to discourage, not to discourage these people. Now, the black people who are already there are being lectured about what they must do to be open to other white people possibly returning so that their loyalty is not rewarded and the disloyalty of the white folk is acknowledged as a motivation to get them back. So wow. That was jacked up on all fronts for the black people there gathered.
You bring up in your book how there are some similarities between RFK, that leader from 55 years ago, and the man considered perhaps the most liberal white politician today, Bernie Sanders, who, you know, has embraced the cause of racial equality, but not until he was pushed, confronted angrily and very openly by activists with Black Lives Matter. Are those similarities something that we should remind ourselves of as we approach other politicians today?
That's absolutely right. Bernie Sanders, seen as the most open-minded, though Bobby Kennedy was a young man at 42, Bernie Sanders is in his mid-70s, and, you know, but still seen by many young people as one of the great politicians in this country, the most progressive, a hope for those who have ideas that are far more liberal and to the left than centrist Democrats. So, yeah, he's seen as the future and the hope, ironically enough, even though he's at that ripe age. But there are tremendous parallels. Bernie Sanders, you know, was slow to the table, so to speak. He was resentful at first when he was confronted by Black Lives Matter. He basically wanted to ride on his laurels, rest on his laurels from 50 years ago when he attended, you know, events around the March on Washington and did a few things back then as if that were sufficient, as if that was the latest installment in the necessarily ongoing revolution of race in this country. And he was challenged on it, and he pushed back upon. And folk really got at him that he was not as enlightened and understanding about the issue of race and others as well, and that he must be, and that he must be educated, and that he must educate himself. And to his credit, he has increasingly come around, but as you said, he had to be forced there. It was no voluntary step or approach he made. And as a result of that, we see a parallel between Bobby Kennedy being pushed hard, made angry first before he eventually came around, and Bernie Sanders, who has been pushed hard and perhaps angered as a result of the refusal of Black Lives Matter to give him a pass before he has now recognized that there was a lot he had to learn about race and that he continues to learn to this day.
So, Michael Eric Dyson, your book, What Truth Sounds Like, is also primarily a book about Black art and culture as part of that shift that needs to happen, or as part of what contributes to the shifting that needs to happen. So, confrontation, conversation, dialogue, All of that through sitting down and meeting in a room like it happened in 1963, but also through the art. And it's not, I think, a coincidence that those people gathered in that room with RFK were so many artists and performers, and James Baldwin himself, an essayist, so really a cultural figure with Lena Horne, the celebrated actress Lorraine Hansberry, the celebrated playwright, as you said, Harry Belafonte. So let's cut to today and how Black art and culture also has the power to shift that conversation, to address those hard truths and force America to have that reckoning on race that we've never had. You mentioned Jesse Williams and Black Panther. So you put them in that same category as those greats from 50 years ago?
Well, I would certainly put them as some of the most prominent figures. Yeah, Jordan Peele did a hell of a work with Get Out. I mean, that has become a language unto itself. Even white folk get it. The sunken place. What does that mean? How do we deal with the sunken place? How does that language articulate a sense of Black envelopment, a Black hole into which some Black people are forced or choose to go?
Right. Peele's film took on liberal whites, not overtly racist white, but liberal whites.
Liberal whites, those who were open-minded and yet who were absorbing and vulturizing the culture and literally absorbing Black bodies to articulate their white meanings. This is what that film is literally about. Again, like with Bobby Kennedy, a challenge to the liberals, not to those who are racists on the right, though they need to be addressed as well. When you think about Black Panther, about a Black universe that doesn't take, you know, white supremacy and white colonialism as its object of, you know, examination, but the presumption of a Black universe as the norm, that is the limit of our existence, that is the need we have to fulfill to love and embrace each other, to fight each other, to work out our differences with each other. And then whiteness gets involved, but not in a way that historically acknowledges the white supremacy that pervades the world. So that was a kind of Black utopia that was articulated. But much of hip hop has been wrestling with police brutality. When Jay-Z says, back then, back when, the police was Al-Qaeda to Black men. When Kendrick Lamar speaks about it, when, you know, KRS talks about it, hip hop has been grappling with that. After police coming straight from the underground, a young brother got it bad because I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. NWA back in the late 80s, early 90s. So there's no question that contemporary art does this. Jay-Z and Beyonce have evolved. Not only have they dropped an album recently that's broken the internet and changed the lives of so many people, but they have also grappled with their evolving consciousness as Black people and artists and citizens of this country, this globe, this world, bringing an awareness about what wokeness means, leveraging their tremendous artistic power and cultural capital in defense of vulnerable Black bodies and others whose backs are against the wall. So yeah, there are many parallels between what was going on then and what's going on today, and artists who leverage that, but also activists who are athletes who speak up. In my book, I talk about, you know, Muhammad Ali from the 60s, a figure, and 70s, a figure that James Baldwin admired and that many of us did, but also to look at the parallels between what was happening then with Ali and what's going on now with LeBron and Colin Kaepernick and those football players, Malcolm Jenkins and Michael Bennett and others who have talked about the need to address the issue of unarmed Black people being assaulted by the police, law enforcement being aggressive, the criminal justice system standing in need of reform. These are figures who have used their pulpits and their platforms to articulate interests of the masses of Black people that need to be addressed.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
All right. God bless. Thank you so much for having me on.
Michael Eric Dyson is a prominent public intellectual, author of the New York Times bestseller Tears We Cannot Stop, university professor of sociology at Georgetown University. He's also a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and a contributing editor for the New Republic and ESPN's The Undefeated. We've been discussing his newest book, What Truth Sounds Like, RFK, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.